Well, good evening, everyone. I'm very excited to be here. I first want to say how thankful I am for the congregation for not only hosting this meeting, but for inviting me to be one of the speakers. I'm very thankful for that. And I hope the things that I have prepared tonight will leave us better understanding God's Word, and not only just that, but to go home and ask questions about the Bible itself with our friends, our family, and even try to stump our local preacher. Tonight, I'm going to start my lesson by saying the same thing I'm going to say at the end. God is our priority. This evening, I've been allowed to speak on the response given by Paul to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. This is a fascinating verse in the most exciting book. And it's because it starts off not so much as a question, rather, though it appears to be a statement. But Clay, isn't this meeting supposed to be about great questions in the Bible? Allow me to explain. Let's first break down what's being said here in verse 1, because it serves two purposes. The first purpose of it is explaining the context of what's going on here by saying, now concerning the things which you wrote. So the book of 1 Corinthians was Paul's response to a whole lot of crazy. In chapters 1 through 6, he's responding to a letter from the people or house of Chloe, who reported to Paul about fights and disunity amongst the church at Corinth. But when he says, now concerning the things which you wrote, it shows that he's turning his attention from Chloe's letter to another letter sent to him by the Corinthian brethren. And that's where the second part of verse 1 comes in, explaining that he's writing about this idea of it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, I say all that this to explain that we have no idea how this original letter was written to Paul. It's simply been lost. It could have been a passing phrase in the letter sent to him, and he noticed it and was like, wait a second, you guys said something that's pretty important here, and I need to address it. Another possible reason for this letter could have been because factions had started happening in the church over this argument, with some saying we must be single, and others saying that's not right. And others just caught in the crossfire, not knowing what to do. Though, this statement could have easily been a question to Paul, because he was single himself. But no matter how you want to put it, we just don't know what the original intention behind this letter was. We just know that something important is being addressed, and the bottom line was that the Corinthians were in a hot mess, and Paul was here to set them straight. So, let's go ahead and break down why it's good for a man not to touch a woman. The three big questions for the statement are, one, what does it mean by good? Two, what does touch mean? And three, is this principle being only applied to men or women or both? By looking at what the original Greek writings meant, it turns out that good meant something profitable, and touch means to get married. So the principle being taught here was that it is profitable that no one, meaning this principle of life was being applied to both man and woman, should get married. That way we can all devote ourselves to God with zero distraction. And though this might sound like a really good idea, and even Paul agrees with it as we'll see in this chapter, there's an issue. Paul in verse 2 says, but. This is implying that, okay, I hear your idea, but there's more to it than that. You're forgetting about immoralities. You see, when God made man back in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, he was made to tend God's beautiful and perfect garden. And in verse 18, God said, it's not good for man to be alone. So let me make him a helper. But of all the different creatures that God made, none turned out to be that perfect helper. Which, according to verse 20, Adam longed for some sort of perfect help. He had a sense of what's called epithemia, which means a desire for something. And what that something for man was the perfect companion. So God created woman to help fulfill all the needs of man, both spiritually and physically. And at first, this relationship was perfect. Adam and Eve serving in God's garden as the perfect first man and woman. But as man tends to do so, we went and messed it up. And because of that mess up, It created one of the largest industries of revenue in the world, pornography. As of writing this lesson, 5% of the top 100 searches of 2023 were for pornographic sites. And I say this to make the point that it's so easy for us nowadays to just get online and look at whatever we want. But don't worry, this isn't just an issue we face nowadays. The Corinthians also were drowned by temple prostitutes and fornication everywhere they turned. And this was a big problem for them, just like it is for us in today's society. So what's the solution? Marriage. In verses 2 through 5 of 1 Corinthians 7, Paul elaborates what he means. Verse 2, "But because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife, and each woman is to have her own husband. The husband must fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." Here, Paul starts off by saying that each man or woman is to have their own husband or wife. Though, when he says each, that doesn't mean that every single person must get married. Rather, each person that is struggling with lust, they are the ones who should get married. So, as a couple, you've both come together for the reason of helping each other. And as a husband or a wife, you are to give yourself over to your spouse, not withholding your body from them. Unless it's for one reason. You and your spouse have both mutually agreed for a time to separate. Now, the reason you choose to do so, if you guys even choose to do, could be for a number of things according to Paul, like the example he gives for prayer. But the main point for saying this was to stop couples from starving each other for the purpose of the relationship. Because if they do, it forces the other person to fall back into their lustful passions and to go about finding it from another source, which defeats the whole purpose of the marriage. Because the whole point of marriage is the coming together of two people who both realize they need help and committing themselves to each other for the spiritual and physical companionship. And we'll look at its ultimate purpose during our conclusion. But first, I want us to look at what the other side of the coin is. What was this argument about remaining single? Let's go ahead and look at verses 7 and 8 and 28 and 35. Starting in verse 7, Paul begins saying how he wishes that everyone was just like him, meaning that he wants us all to be able to resist the lustful temptations in our life. But what's so great about being single? Let's read Paul's explanation in verses 28 through 35. Verse 28, "But if you marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Yet such will have trouble in this life, and I am trying to spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time has been shortened, so that from now on those who have wives should be as though they had none, and those who weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the word, the world, as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. This I say for your benefit, not to put a restraint upon you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord." The point being made here is time management. He starts off by first saying, "Hey, if you don't get married, I understand. And don't feel like you've sinned." Though, in the second part of verse 28, he transitions to what he's trying to explain by remaining single. which is to prevent troubles in this life. In verse 29, Paul tells them that life is short. And because of that, all the things we gain in this temporary life, a spouse, pain, sorrow, times of gladness, and earthly possessions, will be gone so quickly, it will almost be like we've never had them. So why would we spend all our time worrying about the things of this world and cause extra concern for ourselves when we can just cast all our troubles to the wind? Because then you can use that little bit of time here on earth to serve God with pure devotion. Now, maybe wondering, similar to how I'm wondering myself, does this mean I should be single? Well, let's go ahead and look back at the beginning of verse 35, shall we? This I say for your own benefit, not to put a restraint upon you. Here Paul explains that this wasn't meant to be an instruction of hindrance. Rather, it was meant to show that there's another way to serve God. And this happens to be what he does along with a few other Christians. This concept was never meant to stop people from getting married and drive marriages apart. It was just him saying, hey, some of us serve God as single people, and some of y'all serve God as a couple. Now, an example of a single Christian serving God is seen with Paul, seeing how he was stoned, bitten by a snake, thrown in jail for being a Christian, and traveled the world preaching the gospel, all while being single. And it was just easier that way for him. Now, an excellent example of couples serving God is found in Acts chapter 18, verses 2 through 26. With the power couple of the Bible, Aquila and Priscilla. Here we discover that a couple of Christian Jews had gotten kicked out of Rome, and they had ended up in Corinth as tent makers. And you know who else was there? The fellow tent maker, Paul. So while he was there, this wonderful couple opened up their home to him, showing him amazing hospitality. Later in the chapter, it's even recorded that they traveled with him to Syria and then to Ephesus, where Paul left them. But even when by themselves, they still did great works by correcting a younger preacher who, when he spoke something wrong, they didn't berate him publicly into other churches saying he's a false teacher. Rather, they simply pulled him aside and taught him the word more accurately, and then helped him get started as a better teacher for the word of God. This is living proof of what a beautiful Christian relationship should look like. Showing that, yes, we can serve God as a single Christian or as a couple. And either way, it will be awesome. Though this begs the question, how do we make an awesome relationship? Well, first a word to the Christian couples. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22 through 29. Here Paul is writing to the Ephesian couples, and he first starts with the women part of the relationship in verses 22 through 24. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Here Paul is beginning with the women on how they can help the Christian home. He paints the picture that women are to submit in everything to their husband. Thayer writes that the word in everything here means in every way, on every side, and in every particular. Paul gives examples of what this level of submission should look like, saying how they submit to God as a willing steward, or like how Christians submit to Christ and his teachings. This is the same amount of submission that should be shown and applied to your husband, like you're submitting to the Lord. Women are to respect and honor their husbands. Even if he makes a decision that you might not agree or like at the time, wives are to submit to their husbands. And trust me, I'm not saying this because one day I'm excited that I'll get to control my own wife, because it's not about control. As a husband and wife, you guys are a team. What's being written to women here is that in order to show that you're submitting to God, you've got to submit to your husbands. Though there is a time where wives can disobey their husband, according to Colossians chapter 3, verse 18, where Paul writes that you are to obey your obey your husband as long as it's fitting in the Lord. Meaning, if your husband asks you to do something illegal, you can say no. Though, I'm sorry, women, there is nothing illegal about a foot rub. Okay, guys, our turn. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25 through 29. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church, and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of the water with the word, so that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to also love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. This is such a deep and beautiful picture given to us. Here, we as the husbands are told that our wife is to have our absolute love. Paul could not have done a better job describing it. He first says we are to love her as much as Christ loved the church. And Jesus died for her. It's an absurd amount of love. He also says we are to love our wives as much as our own bodies. We wouldn't normally neglect our bodies as men. We want to take care of ourselves. And here we're told that for our wife, she is to have our love and more. He then gives another command to husbands, explaining how we can ensure the ultimate power couple status, saying that as husbands, our job is to be constantly studying, encouraging, helping, and provoking our wife in all good things. We are to be on constant watch that she is protected from the evils of the world, and ensure that if anything dares to try and hinder her as a Christian, we are there to help her fight and overcome these evils. And by doing so, it will not only help our wife grow and become a better Christian, but also help us as men to sharpen our own spiritual swords. And a family full of sharp spiritual weapons is not one the devil wants to tangle with. Now, what if our spouse is not in the church? Are we to leave them because they are a hindrance to our Christian life? Well, the answer to that question is no. Rather, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 12 through 14, that if our unbelieving spouse still agrees to live with us, because back then they would try and justify that if someone was of a different religion, then that was good enough reason to get a divorce. He writes to them, telling them that the believing spouse is to stay and set the proper Christian example, showing that, hey, I'm going to church because I believe in a higher purpose. And we're told that by doing so, it'll hopefully convict the non-believer. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, this is an absurd idea, it'll never work. That's how my great-grandpa was converted. He spent years never going to church. But as my great-grandma would take their three kids to church every Sunday, he started reading his Bible. And when he was 90 years old, he was baptized. Talk about a long-awaited victory. And that's just one story of hundreds, if not thousands of couples in the church. Okay, so we've talked about the pros and a couple cons about being single or married. We've even covered how to build an awesome home as a couple, or how to build one as a single Christian in a home of non-believers. But what does it all lead to? What's the main idea and purpose behind this teaching? Well, the answer is that in all walks of life, God is our focus. Life is going to stink at times, whether we're married or single. There will be days when nothing is going right. But with God as our focus, what can go wrong? Whether we are traveling the world as a single Christian like Paul, or as a couple doing the work of the Lord, helping whoever we can like Aquila and Priscilla, the bottom line is that in whatever relationship we pursue in life, it is all made beautiful and perfect when we make God our priority. Thank you.